Hello and welcome to the HSJ Health Check podcast. My name's Ben Clover and this week I'm standing in for Annabelle Collins. This week I'm joined by my two colleagues, Dave West and Mimi Launder. And we're going to be discussing a couple of the big stories that we've broken or have been kind of in the national press and with a bunch of extra work that we've done on them this week. First up, I'm going to take us to Dave. And Dave has written a really interesting story about the government's Community Diagnostic Centre programme. It's worth pointing out before we get into this that the relative lack of diagnostic equipment in the NHS is what explains the NHS's relatively poor cancer mortality outcomes, and it's a sort of an ambition in the long-term plan was to raise the number of people diagnosed at stages one and two of cancer rather than three and four, when it's obviously more treatable, to get that to 75% by 2028, and at the moment we're around kind of the mid-50s, so languishing some way. But yeah, Dave, can you take us through what your story was?
Yeah, as you say, opening lots of community diagnostic centres, getting on for 200 by 2025 is a big part of government and NHS England plans at the moment, mostly focused on cancer diagnosis, but diagnosing other things as well. And It's the main way of investing in the main route, or perhaps virtually the only route of investing in diagnostic capacity, capital at the moment, especially for those big expensive MR and CT machines. And it's sort of, you know, I think you can come in on this, Ben, because you've been covering it a lot as well over the last months and years, but it's sort of been, in one sense, kind of quite a successful program to some degree. But quite a lot of these centers have been opened, about 105, 106 operational. I think there's a lot of kind of provisos and things that we can talk about to that are quite important, about, you know, they're not, the CDC's not necessarily all have the same fully singing, dancing diagnostic equipment. Is it actually additional capacity, because they may have had to divert staff and revenue from elsewhere to actually run them anyway? Are they in the community actually, or are they basically at acute hospital where there was already diagnostic capacity? So kinds of questions around it. But in another sense, it's been fairly successful, and especially if you compare it to the new hospitals program, which is the government's other big capital spending thing at the moment, then, you know, capital has been spent and centres have been opened and machines have been bought and put in place and things, albeit isn't making a big enough difference yet to the cancer diagnostic backlog, and therefore to those early diagnosis and survival rates. But bringing things up to what this story was this week, in the latest sort of tranche of proposals, bids to open community diagnostic centres around the country, like about 30 of them are in this cohort. These proposals have been in the process of getting to the centre, to NHS England and to Steve Barclay, who must finally sign these things off in order to for them to put in the orders and spend them, commit the money and go ahead. Come to him over the last couple of months or so. But he has, it's transpired, HSJ learned, set a deadline, a very firm deadline, back to NHS England and civil servants to say, I will not sign off any that cannot be opened by December 2023. Well, there's a whole bunch of them, several dozen, as I say, about 30, where they weren't planning to open by December 2023 because that they didn't think they'd be able to. They were planning to open in 2024, the first half of 2024. And so they are now very concerned, and NHS England is very concerned about what's going to happen to these proposals, because they because effectively the Secretary of State has said they will not be signed off then. So some of them, you know, they're kind of looking around, as you can do, is there anything we can do to bring this forward into 2023 and therefore get sign off? There were it said that actually some projects, a small number of projects, probably have been able to be brought forward. Whether that's really in for the benefit of anyone, I don't know. In those cases, maybe some of them it was, you know, a case of actually they could shake the suppliers and a bit, and it's brought things forward, and so they'll be able to start diagnosing people earlier. Great, who wouldn't want to see that? In other cases, they just said it's just not possible. Largely, in most part, because the suppliers of the machines have said that they cannot supply the machines on that timetable. They're big, complicated, expensive things to manufacture. There's quite a lot of competition for them at the moment. In this, you know, there's quite a lot of orders in this country as well as elsewhere. And so they said they won't be able to do it. There's a few areas looking for sort of fudges to get around this, like by using mobile diagnostic trucks that can be supplied by private providers to sort of, you know, make it look as if one has been, you know, it has been open, treated at least one patient perhaps in December 2023. So the box can be ticked in a rather arbitrary way. But a lot of the you know, experienced officials and leaders involved think that's a fairly, you know, unhelpful distraction in this case, because, you know, it's not actually going to add capacity. What we need to do, you know, it just needs to do is sustainably build up diagnostic capacity. So that's the where we've got to.
So it seems like kind of that if you're being charitable, you could say, hey, look, some of these projects could be accelerated, you know, kind of with enough push, then some things that might otherwise have been opening in, you know, mid or early mid 2024 might come through to 2023, which is, you know, obviously good if you can staff them. But on the other hand, just things that might otherwise have been due to open in 2024, but will be forming that capacity now, just might not, because it's like early or not at all.
Yeah, at least that's the reality they seem to be facing. They feel they're facing at the moment is that, well, are you just saying this just will not happen then? Isn't that a fairly, excuse me, arbitrary and short-term way of seeing things? I mean, it may well be that the Secretary of State in the end just gives way on that firm deadline and says, okay, well, you've managed to bring forward a few, you know, I'm just going to have to sign this off. And back down, but he's taken quite a long time about it. You know, this also tells us something about the kind of ongoing rumblings about Steve Barclay's style and approach, that he likes to set these sometimes arbitrary deadlines. Lots of Secretary of States and ministers behave a bit like that, but he's got a particular reputation for setting these things where there doesn't appear to be any rationale for it. And not listening to people when they say, well, you know, we've tried, but we just can't see a way through this one. The tensions between Department of Health and NHS England as well on that, because NHS England's managing the CDC programme, it's sort of Mr. Barclay's seeming sort of inclination to not trust or not want to believe the first answers of public servants and to like to challenge and push back on them quite often. And of course, it sort of manifests as, even if he does eventually give way, at the moment, this is manifesting quite a long delay to those ones. If they are going to go ahead in 2024, well, they would have rather ordered the machine 4 or 6 weeks ago when they initially thought they could be, or NHS England people would have rather, people working out in the regions, whatever, would have rather have just got on with the order. And the sooner that you get these wheels in motion, the sooner in 2024 it will be open. Whereas the delay creates uncertainty and people go off and work on other things, and it ultimately in some cases it can slow down the opening rather than speed it up.
Maybe he's thinking, kind of like, well, the actual ordering equipment isn't going to be the crucial thing anyway, because he probably knows better than anyone outside the CDC program itself. But there's just not staff in most cases that kind of, yeah, that what, so the kind of a capital budget for CDC is sort of well known and kind of banded around quite a lot, even though quite a lot of it was about IT connectivity, but the revenue budget, i.e. the paying for these things kind of month by month, mostly staff cost, has never been disclosed. It's been like very fiercely undisclosed, although there's been lots of talk from inside the program about kind of like that it's not enough, that it's been, yeah, raided multiple times, and you know, the most, yeah, in some ways, yes, you say like it's been quite a successful program, like there is new stuff out there, now new equipment. I mean, in some cases, this will be on the site of an existing DGH, you know, just that, you know, we needed that equipment 15 years ago, but at least it's here now on the DGH. In some cases, it's like you say, on a district general hospital, in a sort of kind of county hospital kind of site. Kind of lots of those ones have got kind of mothballed kind of community hospital sites, and only a few have been out in sort of the shopping centres as was originally envisaged. And kind of lots of cancer people think that basically the backlog in cancer means that, however nice like the Richards vision was on diagnostics, that they do everything and be locally owned, they were basically going to end up being largely part of a sort of cancer infrastructure. But no, it sounded like from a quote in your piece that kind of that staff thought the only real sort of rationale that was obvious was this is a sort of potentially sort of electioneering thing, like we want to be able to point to this many, and what with that and with the mobile units as well.
Yeah. Just in passing, actually, someone I was speaking to this morning from out in a locality was saying that they have several centres open, but the ones that they were hoping to open next are now maybe caught up and hindered by this 2023-2024 row were the case of, well, we're actually going to open some spokes out in more deprived communities where there's not a district general hospital, and where we were hoping to focus the diagnostic equipment on the sort of the needs, you know, the local needs of those communities, yeah, deprived or mind diverse communities and what they need. So yeah, that's the program, you know, should be moving in that direction, and hopefully if it continues it will do. But yeah, the obvious reasons, I suppose, yeah, as you say, the immediate explanation, you know, everyone has said that the Secretary of State has not actually given a reason for this deadline, which sort of seems odd in itself, but maybe that's just how government works. You know, didn't someone push him on the wall? Why is that? I think, you know, I guess the assumption that people are more comfortable with is, well, we want them to be open quicker so that people, you know, patients can get in there and start getting their diagnosis and get treated if they need it. And obviously there's the electoral politics are part of that. In this general election has to be held pretty much in 2024. And everybody's leaping, you know, the obvious, what people are saying is the obvious reason for this deadline is Steve Barclay wants to get these things open a margin before the general election so that, you know, potentially, A, they can announce things. We have opened X number of centres. They can, you know, local politicians can talk about what's been done in their constituency, which is very important going into general elections, you know. Perhaps ribbons can be cut, although you'd have thought that's going to be pretty difficult if it's a mobile unit sort of somewhere on a estate, vaguely not very practical. But, you know, less cynically, I get, perhaps they want these lists to be coming down and to be showing more progress on diagnostic backlogs and cancer backlogs going into that election year, which is, you know, little cynical, so it's clearly driven by an election, but I suppose that's partly what democracy is about, is sometimes it's driving politicians to do things slightly more quickly. I think there's a big concern about winter as well. You know, there was a terrible winter experience, particularly in November, December, early January this winter just gone, and so Steve Barclay and his team are all kind of you know, burned by the extremity of that. Cancer diagnostics in a way shouldn't be enormously affected by winter, but if you have more capacity it can help protect it through winter pressures from emergency spillover. But you know, at the more sort of cynical end, you think we get it is some people who are having their bids you know, put on ice are thinking, well we don't get to open our centre later in 2024 simply because the election might have happened by then, or, you know, you don't want to spend money which may not benefit you, is obviously people are gonna be feeling pretty cynical about that. I guess the truth is sort of somewhere in the middle, like, you know, elections are clearly playing a part, but hopefully it's not the case that that money's just going to be held back unless it's contributing to the election effort.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, if there is a whole new government, then they'll presumably suspend all capital spending for a little bit it won't be then a given, like your project.
That's a bigger question. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, the bigger question, and on that, you know, we'll come on to talk. We're going to come on to talk about the primary care focus, but the question of you know, where are we spending? Where is the NHS spending its sort of the capital pound between secondary acute care and in community services? I mean, CDC's sort of cuts across that a little bit. You know, as you said, the intention is that more of them are in community, but actually they're quite a sort of a secondary, often more run by secondary acute services. But there's a question, you know, how would a Labour government, if we do get a Labour-led government, prioritise that capital that's kind of earmarked for 40 new hospitals? Or is their recent announcements have been about neighbourhood, community, primary care and community care. So would they shift funding towards that? But different, slightly different subject.
Yeah, no, that does bring us quite neatly to the second thing I want to discuss this week, which was the big announcement on the primary care recovery program. Now, like listeners might have seen some reporting of this elsewhere, but Mimi, you've been leading on this for us. You want to take us through what was in it?
Yeah, of course. It was a sweeping program. I think it's been quite a long time coming, not least because it was delayed, but also problems in general practice have been heaping up since before the pandemic. It's not surprising it's been covered elsewhere, because I suppose that ending the 8 a.m. rush resonates with a lot of people, including us as patients. But from a GP perspective, I think it, even though that really epitomizes the problems for them, it's been continual workload, ridiculously high demand, fewer GPs, or at least for fewer fully qualified GPs than before. So it's a welcome plan, I think, from the GP perspective, but it still has some downfalls, and I'll kind of talk through them now. So lots of points in the plan, as I said. The main thing I think that the government and NHS England are focusing on is general practice access. So they talked about something what they're calling, at least, modern general practice access. So that basically means the same tool, I think, is how people are reading it, is that when you contact practice, the same tool should be used to deal with your query, whether you go through online, whether you go through on the phone, wherever it is. And then it should be dealt with in a more efficient manner than before. This is welcome. It's completely welcome. And I think it makes a lot of sense. It's not a new idea. There are lots of technologies that already provide this. Lots of practices already provide this. But hopefully it should start to solve those problems of at least getting through to your GP, whether then there are enough staff to deal with queries or go through all the bureaucracy of that is a different question. The next big thing is pharmacy first. I don't know if you've come across this, but it's essentially where patients go to their pharmacy before going to a GP to get prescriptions or consultations. It's really well run in other UK countries, but it's not really been a thing here. And I think pharmacists have been calling for it for a really long time. Sajid Javid mentioned it a few years ago, but with a bit of the merry-go-round of health secretaries and all of that, it's kind of been pushed down. But I think, again, this is really welcomed by GPs, really welcomed by pharmacists. There's still concerns about workforce. Are there enough community pharmacists to deliver this? But these all seem like steps in the right direction. And the reaction to the plan has been generally positive, which is really good. But they're all quite big ambitions.
Yeah, because it seemed like some of the reaction I was seeing on social media I saw a lot of GPs complain that, yes, look, more phone lines are welcome and better, but the fundamental number of people available to then have that appointment with you, that's not changed.
Exactly.
Letting more people through. Although it sounded like the pharmacy announcement might be a bit more consequential in allowing them to prescribe more things, i.e. so that would make some difference to the actual fundamentals of supply and demand there, right?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it often, I think patients will approach GPs for almost any problem. It might be a social problem. It might be not being able to get through to your hospital. It might be something that could be dealt with by a pharmacy. Pharmacies have been asking for this for such a long time, as I said. So it's kind of just a no-brainer, I would say, to allow them more decision making and more responsibility, really. Again, workforce, and it's the same thing with access to your GP. You might not get to a ringtone or get cut off or anything like that anymore, but it's hard to say how much quicker it will be. I think one good thing is that because of the focus of on online approaches, requests can be dealt with quicker. I went to a GP actually recently and I watched them. And when a request gets through on your computer online, it's remarkable how much more quickly they can deal with it. But it also does mean changing patient perspectives. And then realizing that maybe seeing a pharmacist or having to put your query for an online form is just as efficient.
Right. And you say this is already been done quite effectively in
yes.
these devolved nations.
Ah, yeah, exactly. Specifically the pharmacist prescribing, so patients can just go straight to the pharmacy and
gotcha.
For a common okay. condition, exactly. Yeah.
Because I do remember historically there's been like lots and lots of calls by pharmacy to be like to let us do more, and I've never quite understood why that hasn't happened. Maybe that's to
yeah.
do with the,
I think it's one of the biggest funding boosts to pharmacy outside of the contract in years and years and years. So it does come with $645 million attached. I think that might have been one of the big obstacles to getting this through.
Right.
Previously.
Right. Yeah, I noticed. I thought the word you don't see in these reports very often, the money's retargeted, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah. From,
way of saying it's not new money, but. Slightly brushing over the fact of where it's been retargeted from, seeing as there's not presumably not many areas hope we're just keen to retarget it. We have asked, but see
no it's,
so
I mean it's definitely a question that needs answering. And if
in the absence
about...
of firm data, we've got to just assume it's the revenue budget of the CDC program, given how few new stories. Sorry,
that's true. No, you're right though, and it is a question that needs answering. And given that a lot of the plan is talking about another big part of it was self-referrals, so patients might be able to go directly to a physiotherapist, which they can do already in lots of areas, but other professionals too. You know, if this money has been directed from elsewhere, we kind of need to know from where, because it all does line together.
Yeah.
And then the big one, sorry, go on, Ben.
No, sorry, go on.
One of the big ones that we did a story on was NHSE's ambition, and the government's, for patients in over 90% of practices to see their records and do a whole host of other things using the NHS app by March 2024. There's four or so markers of this. One of them is messaging, one of them is records. One of them is booking and managing appointments, and the other is ordering repeat prescriptions. NHSE says that only about 20% of practices are currently there with all four of those things. So achieving this by March 2024 seems a big jump. There's already a target for practices to allow patients to access their patient records by this October. We did another story recently that revealed some ICBs have as few as 6% of the practices offering this, while others have more like 66%. But in general, it's around the 20% mark. So there's a long way to go to hit all these targets. And I think for smaller general practices, ones with only one GP, ones with not many staff, ones who like the way they work, there's going to be less motivation, less time to meet these targets. So it's ambitious from NHSE.
Yeah, I was interested by the fact that it's an October deadline, and people don't broadly tend to set deadlines for themselves that they've no chance of hitting. Kind of, do you get a sense of what kind of program this will involve? Is it something where you can basically buy one massive bit of software and then just send a link to everyone, and then boom, you're technically kind of connected, you know, or is it more complicated? I mean, I'm sure it's a bit more complicated, but is it much more complicated?
With the records in particular, practices have different systems and suppliers for managing these. There's two big ones that I'm for the practices with those EMIS and TPP, it will be a lot simpler to make the switch. There's still a lot of questions over concerns for patients around safeguarding, so patients who maybe should have some redacted access to the records, and the work it takes to actually sort through that. Because there are so many measures, for example, secure messaging through the app, I'm not actually sure whether that's something that is just automatically enabled through the app, but it does kind of bring into question the fact that if all practices are going to be on the NHS app, it's going to have to function quite well if that's the only option, or at least the option for most practices. It's going to have to provide a lot of services that are otherwise provided by other providers and suppliers.
Oh, so it could yet be quite a knotty thing in sort of contract terms, where this one GP federation has signed this one deal for 5 years with a smaller provider or something. And sorry, did I understand you right? That kind of like most of the like EMIS and TPP can be plugged in fairly easily.
It's just a matter of them doing it on a system-wide basis for those bigger companies. But it still requires a lot of work for practices to sort through records, make sure it's all up to date, make sure it's all safe.
Gotcha, I guess. And maybe that is possible if there's a bunch of central support for the actual practices to do the going through each thing. Like I say, it's not an unbusy part of the health sector. I was looking at your story about the places with fewer than 1 in 10 and the places that offer their patients access to their records. Was there anything sort of in common in the six ICBs that have 1 in 10 or fewer practices offering those? I mean, I could see a sort of a fair spread, but there didn't seem to be any sort of like unifying theme.
No, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of them were arguing, I think, that patients could still request records, which is completely true. I think in that way, they're probably waiting for closer to the deadline, because there are companies that haven't quite made that all across the board switch that might apply to more practices in their area. But I'm aiming to talk to more practices who haven't switched yet, because I get the sense, particularly from those smaller practices, that the workload is just so high.
Gotcha. And I guess this is sort of a question for both of you, really. But do you get a sense with the primary care recovery plan that does it leave any sort of big questions unanswered? I mean, I know workforce is going to be,
only enough who on workforce sort of how news and government works nugget on that. In that, one of the reports, the Politico report, had this strange line in it saying that sort of apparently out of nowhere, saying that the government's going to increase GP training places by 50% over the next 15 years, which appears to be, can't be much else apart from a line from their said to be forthcoming long-term workforce plan. But perhaps there were discussions about putting it into this announcement or something, because that obviously is a kind of answer to the workforce thing, only partial, because there's so much it's about retention and everything. But there would make sense, but it seems just strange. This Department of Health seems to have accidentally announced part of the a crucial part of the long-term workforce.
I think Steve Barclay,
very little noticed. We have asked them what's going on with this then, but so far silence.
Steve Barclay seemed to hint at it a little bit yesterday, more training places in the House of Commons. So I'm sure that will be coming in the workforce plan. So much of it relies on the workforce plan. I know you've already said it, but self-referrals, they'll create more workload for other professionals. I think it's just that one big question.
Rumbling. Yeah, that's the underlying thing, isn't it? But the other thing, like you said, this is very focused on access, short-term access. And again, it's electoral timetable. It's a sort of a 1-2 year, like inverted commas, recovery of access, focusing on that 8 a.m. rush problem. But there's a whole program of reform and modernization improvement that is happening in sort of primary and community services. That was the last attempt sort of set out was in the Fuller review, whereas this kind of and this plan acknowledges it sets most of that, leaves most of that for the to sort out as a future date, really. You know, some of the practices are getting into it already, but it talks about that as a longer term agenda, and this recovery plan says we will be, I forget, there's some good bureaucratic language about sort of engaging, ferociously engaging over the summer or something about what happens with the longer term GP contract and with quality and outcomes framework and with, you know, what's the terminology for it? Something about how to give GPs more control of the services around their area and reinvesting saved funds or something, which sounds almost like Andrew Lansley 2010, you know, reinventing clinical commissioning. But I'm sure that's not what they're getting at. I guess what they're getting at is how do we develop the next stage of primary care networks, to turn a primary care network into a scale NHS provider or a nationalized sort of provider unit, or a neighborhood, you know, neighborhood team with some sort of more substance about it that can help be a basis for expanding primary and community services. And we've got kind of interesting ideas from both political parties have said dramatic things about GP primary care reform over the last couple of years, that would be a much more 5 or 10 year project rather than a 2 year, you know, please upgrade your phone systems and hope it makes things a bit better.
Yeah, it's probably not much can be done over 2 years to fundamentally change how that works. Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much for your time, the pair of you. I hope that's been useful for our listeners. The HHA Health Check podcast is available on, I think, all the major podcast platforms. Next week, I believe, Annabelle's taking back over again. But in the meantime, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you all soon. Thanks.